Hey everyone, Raghu back here with Mind Rolling and another new friend, Ralph De La Rosa. Ralph, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I always say I have a new friend because it always turns out that's the beauty of podcasts, that you sit down with somebody that you don't really know. Mm-hmm. And you might have read some of their stuff or whatever, or seen them on YouTube. And then the next thing you know, wow, it's the beauty of that kind of connective communication. It's really quite wonderful. Indeed. So that's why I say new friend, because I know that's what's going to happen. Ralph is a therapist, a meditation teacher, storyteller, and musician. I didn't know the musician part. You'll have to tell us about that.
Sure.
And I came across Ralph because of his new book, Monkey is the Messenger. Now, I am very, very fond of a monkey. it's in a different context than the book, though. And it's a monkey called Hanuman from India. And that is actually our whole lineage, Ram Dass and me, Krishna Dass, is a monkey. So it's and even when they talk about stories of Hanuman, they always talk about, he did things like, you know, a monkey does, like just bounding from tree to tree and eating fruit and being happy and free. But in this case, monkey mind is a bit of a different thing in terms of the myth that we are creating for ourselves on a day-to-day basis. So, Ralph, we just talked before we got on about, I really want to know, how did you get into this stuff?
And thank you. And I appreciate your vote of confidence with regards to being friends by the end of this. And I'll just say before that, part of my story is that at one time I was actually a Hare Krishna ashram devotee when I was about 19 or 20 years old. And so it's interesting that you bring up Hanuman, and I had never really thought about the parallel between the Buddha's metaphor of the monkey mind and Hanuman being a servant of Lord Vishnu in the Hindu Vedic mythos. And there's definitely a strong parallel there around the monkey mind, maybe becoming more in service of the whole self, just as Hanuman is a servant of Krishna.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things that we came back with from India, from our time with, I'm assuming you know, we really haven't talked now, everybody out there. I'm assuming you do know about, of course, Ram Dass's guru, Neem Karoli Baba, that we were with, and we followed Ram Dass back to India all that time ago. What was brought back is called the Hanuman Chalisa, 40 verses in praise of the monkey god. One of the central things of the whole thing is these all are references, the couplets are all references to reminding him who he really is and ultimately who you really are in the doing of it. And there's always references. Yes, he behaved like a monkey and he did this, that, and the other, and he was powerful physically, et cetera, et cetera. So, if we are reminding who he is and who we are.
Right. What a huge theme for all of us, really, who, you know, we forget our true nature in the fray and fuss of life all the time. And I mean, with regards to my history and how I ended up here on this path and how I ended up here holding the seat, the very humbling seat of a teacher on some occasions, really is a story of trauma in that I had, just from a very early age, things started going really wrong, as it does for so many of us, too many of us, really. In terms of just abandonment of my dad walking out of my family and developing a depression and suicidal ideation very early at the age of 8, and really wanting to find a way out of that, which was kind of two-tiered for me. And the first thirst for me was really wanting to know the truth about life and having a sense, even from a very young age, of you know, that this can't be it. This can't be what we're here for. This can't be why I was born into this world. And being confused about that, and confused about why nobody seemed to have the answers, which led to the second tier, the second thirst, if you will, that depression gave me, which was to escape, to find a way out. You know, if everybody's confused around me and I'm confused, then, you know, at least let's try to feel better. And so that's those two kind of poles really drove my journey. And in two distinct ways, but that actually had a lot of overlap. And, you know, some things happened in high school where, you know, I was assaulted a number of times and developed PTSD and worsened the depression and so on. And, you know, when I got out into the world as a young adult, very, very confused and very much kind of trying to outrun myself. And I found a spirituality that spoke to me, but I also found drugs simultaneously. And those also spoke to me in a different way. And then there came some experiences where I kind of tried to use spirituality very much like a drug in an escapist manner, in what we now call spiritual bypassing. Mm. Right? But yeah, and I found the Vaishnavas, the Hare Krishnas, and I spent some time living in an ashram in Pacific Beach, California.
Really?
Yeah, that was a beautiful time. And actually, I should even mention that before that came a whole phase with psychedelic usage. And the fateful night that I was at a party, at a potluck of a friend of mine's, and he said, "Hey, have you ever read this book? It's the Tripper's Bible." And he held up "Be Here Now" by Ram Dass. And yeah, that's where it all kind of began for me in terms of...
Tripper's Bible. I don't think I heard that one. I love that. I got to write that down.
Yes, with that sort of endorsement, it was a given that I would pick it up and read it. But that book was really a huge genesis for me, in that it was the first exposure I had to the notion of spirituality that didn't necessarily intertwine with the religion, that could be 100% personal and even open to... interpretation might not be the right word, but you know, we're open to finding our own path and really what our personal dharma is. And the cookbook for a sacred life in the back became my bread and butter for some time in terms of learning meditation and learning asana and learning how to chant, etc. And then, and then came a period where I fell in with the Hare Krishnas, which ended in a very interesting and kind of hilarious way. And here's a story for you. I actually didn't do so well with ashram life.
No,
trying to be a celibate, aspiring sannyasi.
No.
Yeah. At the age of 19, 20, did not fare so well. And so it was kind of known in the temple that I was, quote unquote, cracking up a little bit. I was, you know, acting out and having a lot of heart, a lot of difficulty with the schedule and, you know, my various duties, etc. And I'll try to give you the quickest possible version of this story, but it's kind of amazing, actually, that one day my roommate in the ashram told me, "You know, Ralph, you got to be careful what you wish for when you're chanting the Lord's name, because Krishna he's the granter of the desires of all the devotees, and he'll give you what you're thinking about. He'll give you what you're asking for. So be careful, because you could be thinking about the wrong thing." And so I was so not down with the asceticism of temple life that one day we were in the shrine room and doing our 2.5 hours of japa rounds, chanting Hare Krishna. And I thought, well, let me let Krishna know what I actually want. I want to get out of here. And I started dreaming of this life where I lived in a van and, you know, I could be independent and I wouldn't have to work that much and I could stay connected to the temple and stay connected to Seva, to doing service. And, you know, I could still have lots of time to, you know, do sadhana and spiritual practice. And you know, Krishna, send me a van. You know, this is the answer. Two days later, some new devotees were just suddenly in the ashram, about eight of them. And I was told that they were traveling Sankirtan devotees. Their whole job was to go and sell literature and sell, you know, these books and to chant Hare Krishna in the streets, etc. Yeah. I thought, who are these guys? And they lived in vans. They lived in four of them to a van. The van was their ashram, so to speak, and they traveled. They traveled following alternative concerts across the country to, you know, do this work. And so I, within another 24 hours, well, it turned out serendipitously that one of their crew members had gotten sick and needed to see a doctor, which is why they stopped in San Diego. And then it turned out that this person couldn't travel anymore and they had an opening in their van. And this was within 72 hours of the day that I meditated on Krishna, send me a van. And there was a van for me to go and live in. Yeah. And seven other even more disciplined and ascetic devotees for me to be in extremely close quarters with.
Well, you did get what you wanted, but maybe, maybe not. Eh?
And so the story goes that we were actually following Weezer and No Doubt on tour.
Oh, yeah.
and to sell books to kids who were maybe searching.
Yeah.
And I got as far as Nashville, Tennessee with them when I just kind of snuck out and called my dad who lived in Oklahoma, who came and picked me up and he said, this is for me. Yeah, so from there, you know, I followed Amma for a number of years, but really, my depression worsened actually with the bhakti yoga thing because bhakti, you know, is the highest of the eight limbs of the Ashtanga yoga path, and I didn't really have any of the lower limbs in place for myself. And Buddhism is really what ended up bringing that to me in a very real way. And really discovering the stripped down kind of Vipassana method of just body, breath, and mind. And you're stuck there with yourself. Just work it out. Build a relationship with yourself. That actually ended up being the most transformative thing for me.
I don't know how many times I've had said this on podcast or in retreats and whatever, the exact same thing with almost the same words, Ralph. Then I would take it one further that the steeping in, for us it was Vipassana, but certainly also we hung out with a lot of the Tibetans. Mm-hmm. That crossed into the bhakti yoga, the devotional yoga that was endemic to what we were doing with Neem Karoli Baba. He never said a word about anything because he didn't teach, he didn't pontificate or anything. He'd say, are you going to the course? In English, he'd go, he didn't speak English, but in English he'd go, course? And yeah, we're going to go to we'll go to the course. What the hell is the course? Vipassana course of Bodh Gaya. You know, and anyhow, we got all of that and got that grounding. So the combination of those two things has been really, I would say, our signature, if you were to say, of what this lineage is. And that's why we do these retreats with Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein and on. And that combination is extraordinarily important, and that kind of grounding. Mm-hmm. For when you go into the deep parts of the heart that contain everything.
Yeah.
Everything, you know.
And yeah, Yeah, all the dark as well as all the light.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's in the book, I love the way you put this. I love the way you put a lot of things, Ralph.
Thank you.
Deep down, I was on a sophisticated mission to escape myself.
Yeah.
I love that. And this is, I guess, after many people are on sophisticated missions to escape themselves, even using the spiritual, as you said, spiritual bypassing. Mm-hmm. But this is after you're with Amma, right?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, our nervous systems are very wise and want to keep us really from the darkness that is sometimes, you know, in the heart. Well, is universally in the heart, really, our wounds, our pain, shame, and fear. And, you know, we sense that unconsciously, that if we really did this path, you know, we might open to that. And so it's this funny thing where the spiritual path and meditation is very vulnerable. And we might endeavor to open the heart, but then something in us can take us in a whole different direction to kind of, as if to protect us. And I think that's what happened with me and Amma, was I fell head over heels in love with this woman and was not awake to the way in which I was still compensating for the way that my dad left my family, mm-hmm. and how abandoned and lonely I felt at my core. And so I looked to her to fix that. And, you know, and Amma knows that we, you know, if anybody's ever been to see Amma, then you know that all she does is hug people, right? And,
you know, everybody, Amma known as the hugging saint, is a wonderful saint from South India that comes to America every year. And that she does. There's lines that go on all night. You get in line and to get, have darshan hug, basically. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. So she's aware that we are all missing that in some way, that we all kind of have holes in our heart in some way. And so, I mean, I think that that's a huge impetus for her and the work that she does, is to at least give us one moment of feeling radically accepted and, you know, saturated in love and unconditional love. And that is a beautiful and healing thing. And I think for me, it also became a little bit of an addiction in that, you know, I just thought if I could, you know, get myself into an otherworldly transcendental state with bhakti yoga and just stay there, then I wouldn't have to deal with my actual life. And that caught up with me in a big way.
Yeah, you and everybody else out there. Jeez.
Right. Yeah. Mm. But I got to have some beautiful times with her in the meantime and learned a lot and got to travel across the country with her. And yeah.
Wow, that's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, the stories about Neem Karoli Baba are just amazing in terms of what went on around him. And that kind of unexplainable phenomenon that went down. Mm. So, yeah, some very similar things with Amma at times.
So, we should talk about the thought process, because yeah, you did a nice job here enumerating what we really go through on a moment-to-moment basis in the thinking process and the narrative as you put it, our relentless wounded narratives. Talk about that in terms of how you've gone through recognizing these narratives, recognizing the belief in our thoughts, and being able to find some leverage that allowed for a bit of a different perspective.
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, there's always a subtext to what we're thinking about. There's always a subtext that things are never what they appear to be at surface level. Right? The Buddha said, things are not what they appear to be, and nor are they otherwise. So You know, what we're thinking about is what we're actually thinking about. But underneath, there are themes that if we start to be thoughtful and maybe think a little symbolically or metaphorically, you know, about the narratives that we're holding about our lives, we'll see that there's assumptions about how people behave, about whether or not we live in a friendly universe, about what this life is for, about what, you know, what we're worth. There's all kinds of subtext to what's going on in our minds that is indicative actually of, you know, what we call beliefs, and not like belief as in I believe in God or don't believe in God, but more like assumptions that we have about things. And really those are formed by mostly by our hurts, by the adverse experiences that we've gone through. And so for me, I don't know, it was really just a cacophony of hatred for quite some time. And this is in tandem with, you know, being a devotee of amas, et cetera. I'd leave the ashram, I'd leave the darshan, I'd leave the hugs, and find myself right back in the pit of despair and depression and resentment against, you know, various people that had wounded me in the past, and just a lot of animosity was really present, both going out towards the world and going inwards towards myself. And
but you had the awareness.
Eventually, yeah. I think that's really what mindfulness-based, breath-based meditation began to show me, was like, oh, this isn't, you know, there's a way in which we can become in our thoughts and feelings as opposed to with them, right? There's a way in which we can be so consumed that we don't even really conceive of another way, conceive of, you know, even other people mattering as much as we matter to ourselves. And so I was quite lost in that. And I think the first time that there started to be space between me and my experience was doing mindfulness-based Vipassana style meditation.
It is a long way from ama to Vipassana, though.
A little bit. But the same core of, you know, knowing that that this can't be all there is, that we're not just here to suffer, we're not just here to go through these things, we're not just here, you know, life doesn't suck. That's not
and
the
you die.
Only, right? that's one narrative, but there are other narratives that you can tune into, right? So, yeah. So, I mean, that's a lot of the work that I do with people now as a therapist, actually, is, you know, how do we put a little bit of space between us and our assumptions about what's going on, or our fixation about what we need in order to be happy, or what we need in order to feel safe, what we need in order to feel whole, or how terrifying, you know, facing the wounds of the heart can be. Can we just put a little bit of space between ourselves and that sort of experience, and then we're not so lost in it, we start to have more options.
The narrative, though, I mean, it's good to get a grip on not believing that narrative. And I find that when anything comes up, as anything arises, you know, of course, mindfulness is a great thing if practiced properly. There's a lot of kind of BS mindfulness that's going around, but more in the, shall I say, Joseph Goldstein, by the way, I've said this a billion times, everyone out there, you want to get into understanding mindfulness and being able to actually execute that in your life, get Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness, period. That's all I got to say about it.
Yeah, the real thing.
Yeah. But once that true awareness coming from a place of, as Ram Dass called it, the witness. And it's the witness that's non-judgmental, that is compassion. Mm-hmm. It's compassion. And compassion for yourself and for everybody else. But mostly, let's start with your the for self, because that's where we really get into a narrative that is so self-destructive, as you just rattled off what happened to you. Same thing happened to me, Ralph, when I was when I was a teenager. What is this for? This is not possible.
Yeah,
this is not possible. Living this, these people are automatons, and you know, my. From my parents to the family and the friends and the local and, you know, the whole thing. It wasn't until Bob Dylan actually saved my ass back then when I realized, okay, yeah, we're there is something out there. There is somebody out there that, yeah, this isn't it. This is not it. Yeah. And then it led in a similar psychedelics, of course. Mm-hmm. I say that, of course, because that's what everyone expects in late 60s, early 70s, but which is true. And we talk about, when you talk about drugs, I immediately dismissed, we're not talking about psychedelics, we're talking about addictive drugs, because then you said later, then psychedelics opened up a world, right?
Yeah, well, psychedelics were actually, they opened up a world to spirituality in early adulthood. And then again, I got into the bhakti yoga thing, but with no feet on the earth, so to speak. And so there was a real vacillation between spirituality and then coming, you know, finding myself in the throes of depression and unrecognized trauma and all that came with that. And so really I began using alcohol, cocaine, and eventually heroin to start dealing with that.
Right, right.
And there was a longish period of really trying to do a double life, showing up at the ashram, coming down off of speed, and you know, things like that, that I really thought I was being clever. And
wow.
And really was just in such a numb, reactive, vacillating between a numb and reactive state. And yeah, life gets confusing.
Yeah.
Really does.
Yeah. Yeah. But. Which is, you know, more and more and more reason to do some kind of practice that does, at the very, very least, stop you chasing your thoughts, the chasing monkey mind, which is what this whole book is about. And I love, there's one thing you quote in here from Trungpa Rinpoche, another like favorite teacher of mine. Mm-hmm. And he refers to the shit in your head as subconscious gossip.
Yeah.
I actually never heard him say that, but I love that. Subconscious. Everybody out there, just watch a little bit on a moment-to-moment basis. Like, take out just this. You're going to do this instead of, you know, go out and smoke a cigarette or chew gum or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just going to like really be aware of the all the different crazy ass thoughts that come up in my mind, and how my mind then, it's like, okay, now we're talking to each other. The mind talks back and forth to another entity within the mind, and it becomes this gossipy chatter kind of stuff. And it's like, and at one point you go, wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That's happening? What is that? Where does that, you know?
And how could there be one part of myself talking to another part of myself? And how could those two parts of me have two different opinions?
Yeah, right.
So, or be at war with each other even.
Yeah, or six different opinions.
Exactly. Like, exactly.
And,
you know, I mean, this is really what the book is about, is that that serves a function in our lives. That along with the various calamities that are inherent in this human existence actually aren't, they can be very tragic, but it's not a tragedy that they exist in the first place, that there's something else going on here. And just like people, you know, getting so fed up with that inner dialogue that is sometimes very tense and exhausting and leads to insomnia and all kinds of anxieties, you know, and so they turn to meditation, right? just in that same way, you know, all of the various cycles that we go through, what, you know, you and I in our respective traditions know as samsara, right? Like the cyclical, repetitive nature of things, you know, is really trying to drive us to ask those deeper questions that you, that Bob Dylan helped you to ask when you were younger.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I want to read a little something. The inner life of each person is incredibly unique and complex. Each of us seems to be working with a common basic setup. Memory banks, inner dialogue, the propensity to construe meaning out of experience, spatial awareness, emotional intelligence, and motor functions are all examples of this. Our fundamental motivations seem to be universal. So, and understanding them will help us to get clear on why we are the way we are, so that we could, so we can do something about it, which is just what we just, we've been talking about. And, you know, a lot of people are just getting an idea that there is a way to get beyond being so self-cherishing. That's a beautiful term from the Buddhist jargon, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Just think of it, you know, this self-cherishing, and that there is a way to do that. And these are the kinds of actions that everybody can take to actually break through that. Obviously, this happened for you. You're a good example. I mean, we all are good examples, but yours is a little extreme. Is it more extreme? Yeah, you're a little more extreme. You were living with Ma-Ama and then coming back stoned on speed. Okay, that's extreme. Yeah. I'll have to say that.
That's pretty extreme.
Yeah. So, what was that thing that just broke that for you?
Hitting rock bottom, of course. Hmm. That's the thing. That's the function, is things got so repetitive and got spiraled. And, you know, there's that notion of samsara again, as we spiral, we go in a downward spiral until we hit a bottom. And I had to go away to residential substance abuse treatment for 6 months.
But you had the thing to do that. Many, you know, I mean, it was strong, right?
Right. Yeah.
Which
yeah,
is well, grace, too. I mean, that to me is a whole other level.
Indeed. Indeed. I mean, I shouldn't have, but I had some people in my life that I was very fortunate that didn't give up on me. Mm. And it was in rehab that I really found the space to meditate, that I had an amazing therapist who really looked after me in a lot of ways that were above and beyond, and was introduced to Hatha yoga Yeah, in a significant way. And really, that was the trifecta that opened things up and led me to kind of the shores of sanity, if you will. But I'll just say this, though. When it comes to that self-cherishing, right? Dr. Rick Hansen, a teacher in the Insight tradition, a neuropsychologist, author of The Buddha's Brain and Hardwiring Happiness, he elucidates kind of the neurological basis of basically Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Like what we're all driven by, what we're all motivated by. And that it really, from a brain perspective, comes down to safety, gratification, and belonging. At all times, we are seeking these three things in one form or another. And, you know, it can, that's where we start from. Now, the surface level expression of how we go about it can get quite distorted and twisted up and neurotic and even pathological. But if we look to everything we think, say, and do, we can find that we're trying in some way to go towards safety, gratification, and belonging. And I really think that that's what our self-cherishing, or what's sometimes called the ego, which gets a really bad rap in the Eastern traditions, is really about, is trying to keep ourselves safe in some way. It's really, you know, it's a defense mechanism. And that's really what defense mechanism means, is it's a part of you that's trying to keep you safe in some way. And I don't know. Ever since I really started understanding that, I have a hard time dogging that tendency in myself and others, because I just see that, there's, you know, if you're neurotically trying to keep yourself safe, emotionally safe, physically safe, or neurotically trying to go towards a sense of belonging, such as with endlessly seeking validation, that's actually tells me that there's a wound in there. Or maybe you don't feel good enough, or maybe things weren't so safe for you growing up and you never internalized a lasting sense of security within yourself, you know? Mm. So.
Yeah. And everyone has some of that. We all have some of that. And that's as a result of, well, then we have to talk about karma. We have to talk about the conditioning in our early lives. Yeah. I mean, His Holiness says, if your mother took care of you in a compassionate way like my mother did, that's why I'm like I am, he said. Mm. That's what needs to happen. I think he even said, Western women eventually will be the savior. I don't know why he said Western, and maybe I have it wrong, but I don't think so. Will be not the savior of our future, but would be very important.
Yeah.
Going forward.
Yeah.
To develop compassion.
Yeah.
And so on.
Yeah.
And the it's the aversion, right? The aversion stuff in terms of the self-cherishing. I mean, that is so endemic. I have a new, there's a new sage out there that I don't think you've heard of, who said the most wise thing that I saw the other day on Dr. King's Day, Martin Luther King Day. His name is LeBron James, okay?
Ah.
Okay. LeBron James said, one of the greatest things I loved about Dr. King was his comfort with discomfort. How great is that? I was like, LeBron? Good. And that's something, you know. Yeah. I mean, obviously, Dr. King was comfortable in any, you know, doing whatever he had to do, and there was a lot of situations that had a giant quotient of fear, not only for his own self, but for the people that were around him, and they were his family. So he had tremendous courage, Gandhi-ish courage. I mean, he's incredible. Yeah. But I love the statement, because comfort with discomfort is a tough thing for us to consider. I mean, just think of it in your own life. You know? We don't want that. And that's what you were just talking about. You know,
you're pointing towards that which lies between us and any experience, right? Which is our relationship to what's going on. That we could be in discomfort and hating that discomfort, and that's one way of relating to it.
Yeah,
we could look towards that comfort maybe with curiosity or some equanimity, or knowing that it'll pass, something a little more friendly or warm, and then that places us in a much better situation. It doesn't necessarily change the discomfort, but we're freed from, you know, the reactivity and the aversion.
Yeah, attachment.
Yeah.
As Maharaj used to say, he would just go like this, attachment. He'd say, that was it. That was the whole thing. You know, we were like, okay. There's something else here. Oh, God, did I just lose it? Hang on a second. This is too good. There's a kind of energy. You talk about an energy that we all, you say you need to, we all need to bring into a situation, because it's so easy to say, I'm overwhelmed, man. I can't do it, you know? So you talk about an energy we often need to bring to our practice and our life in the name of no matter whatness. I like that. No matter whatness. Cut through the excuses. Just stop mentally fidgeting around. Stop negotiating. This is good advice. I would like, where are you? Are you in Brooklyn, did you say?
I sure am. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to come and I'll be a patient because this is good stuff, man, Ralph. But I love that. We could drop a sharp, heavy blade right through the resistance. That's tied up into courage to actually put one foot in front of the other, right?
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. I mean, we get the question all the time, well, what do we do about, you know, how do I establish a daily practice? I just can't seem to get myself to do it. And it's like, well, we could talk about some different motivation techniques, but really it just comes down to, like, you put your butt on the cushion and you set the timer and you don't move until the bell rings.
But then, Ralph, I have all these thoughts. I don't know what to do with them. I can't control my thoughts and they just overwhelm me. And I guess I'm not really cut out for meditation because I have too many thoughts.
Right.
How many times have you heard that one?
Yeah. It's what drives me to meditation and away from meditation at the same time. Yeah. You know, it's hilarious, actually.
Yeah.
But, you know, thankfully, that's not an unworkable situation.
Or I mean, I say to people, are you really serious? You really seriously believe? You're the only person who's ever told me that in my entire life, that you have too many thoughts, therefore you're probably not good for meditation.
Right. Right. Maybe I should try Pilates instead.
Hey, now I do Pilates. So
I love Pilates.
Hey, so there's a great story here. Maybe you want to tell it before we have to get off.
Sure.
Diamond Dog.
Yeah, this goes into,
I love this, it's a, into this, is a talk about stories we believe.
Well, I'll just say that the mind spits out a lot of stories, and sometimes they're cute and funny and absurd, and sometimes, you know, they can take you in a really dangerous direction. And so this is a story that's actually has both of those elements in it, because this was actually just a little over a year ago that I was sitting silent retreat out at Blazing Mountain Retreat Center with the Dharma Ocean community, which is who I study with these days.
Reggie.
I was sitting with his closest student, Neil McKinley. And I had never been out there, and I was very, very curious if Reggie was going to make an appearance of some sort at the retreat, or if he maybe lived on the land, because they had all this land, and it's out in Crestone, Colorado, and literally in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, I wonder if he lives out here on the land. I wonder if, you know, he'll be around, et cetera. I kind of had this story in my head, and I go for a walk third or fourth day of the retreat, and I hadn't been around the land yet. And I see a guy coming up on me who's tall and thin and gray hair, and which Reggie is tall and thin and has gray hair. And I thought, you know, for a moment, like, is that him? Am I about to pass him on the road? And then, you know, he got a little closer and I realized, oh no, I've seen that guy sitting at the retreat. It's not him. But it planted this, it refreshed the story I had in my head of, like, you know, is the guru going to be here, basically, right? And I pass some bushes that reveal a house behind the bushes. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. You know, like, there's a house on the land. I wonder if that's where he lives. And I see a finished attic in the window. And I recall this podcast where Reggie had talked about this meditation room being in a finished attic of this house. And I start thinking, this is too close. This is too much. This has got to be where he lives. And just then I see that there's a red truck with its engine running in the driveway. And the engine stops. They had just gotten home. And, you know, my heart sinks a little bit, like, oh my God, it's Reggie and his wife, Caroline, about to get out of this truck. And, like, what do I do? Because I'd really like to meet this man. I'd really like to shake his hand. I'd like to thank him for, you know, the teachings, you know, but I also don't want to put him on the spot. And what am I going to do with, you know, like, you probably hate to get that kind of attention. I know that it's sometimes awkward and uncomfortable for teachers to get, you know, veneration from people when they're just trying to share what's helped them. And, you know, then another part of me just wanted to get down and do prostrations in the dirt right there in the middle of a dirt road. And the door opens to the truck and I just hear this dog barking. And this dog hops out of the truck and I think to myself, this is how I'm going to meet him. This is how I meet him, because dogs love me. I love dogs. This dog's going to come over. We're going to play with each other. You know, eventually Reggie's going to come to fetch his dog. And then it'll be this nice, awkward, or not awkward, opportunity for us to have a friendly exchange. And the dog comes running at me. And I was so in this story that the dog was viciously barking at me and planted its front paws in the ground in attack mode, and I bent down to pet him.
Oh, great.
And a dog lunged at me and began to attack me.
Oh,
and everything just went kind of silent. And it was a really meditative moment, actually, in that just there was no time for thought. There was no time for concepts. There was no time. The story I had in my mind vanished. Everything just sort of went still in a way, except for the fact that this dog was lunging at me and I was jumping backwards trying to get away from him. And then eventually the owner came running up and grabbed the dog. And I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And I look up at the guy and it's definitely not Reggie Ray.
Now, why would Reggie have a sick dog? Come on. Attack
and
dog.
This guy, right. He would have a peaceful dog, of course.
Yeah, right. Another story.
An enlightened dog.
Yeah.
Right. Another story, yeah. Indeed. But this guy, of course, expected me to be freaked out or angry or upset or scared. And I was so taken by the disillusionment of this imaginary narrative that I was caught in that I would doubled over in laughter. And he's sitting there apologizing to me and I'm just laughing uncontrollably. And he just, I mean, he gave me the 1,000-yard stare like I had, you know, seven heads. Yeah. Like, what's going on with you, pal?
That's funny. That's so great. Oh, my.
The stories we tell ourselves.
Yeah, really.
Name of that.
And one of your chapters in the book, "The Monkey is a Mensch." I don't remember that. That's so great. The monkey's a mensch. But you're talking about the greatest story ever told, and I think, I don't know if I mentioned it, but it's exactly some of the things that we've been talking about on different podcasts with different teachers, who many of whom you know well. And our thoughts tell a compelling story, the story of me. My friend Krishnadas has a great aphorism for that. It's called "The Movie of Me." You wake up in the morning, you're the star, producer, director, and the whole day is planned out wonderfully and played out in complete ignorance, you know. And so I came upon this and I was like, okay, we're on the same page here in terms of what I think is so important for people to get, as we've been speaking of this entire podcast, to get awareness, just get there, you know, and to see, like, this story, Ralph, that you just told is beautiful. I mean, that how that was constructed was fantastic, and the motivations for it. And on, you know.
Yeah. And really, if we look at what all of our stories is about, it's, again, it's how can I be happy and how can I not suffer, basically.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Safety, gratification, and belonging. That's really everything. And, you know, like the Dalai Lama said, if we're well-nourished inside, and that can come from a mother, that can come from a father, that can come from another caregiver, or we can learn to offer it to ourselves. which is really the answer, and really what meditation, I believe, is for, is how do we nourish ourselves, not in a narcissistic, neurotic way, but from that place of natural compassion and caring that exists within all of us. If we can nourish the various parts of ourselves from that place, that constant searching and striving begins to die down. We find that we are contented and become more and more peaceful.
Yeah, and practically speaking, you stop believing in your bullshit, basically.
There's that too. You know. There's that too.
Yeah. One thing that you bring up here that I must relay, that's another thing I think is extraordinarily important, and that's around somebody, I can't remember who, Simone Weil, I think, the writer, said the greatest offering that you can make to another human is attention.
Yeah.
And I was so happy to see that you had brought that up. Would you say it's difficult to surrender ourselves for even a few moments? It's hard to give people, and by the way, I am the worst. I am so, I'm one of those people, I can do a lot of stuff, multitasking. Mm-hmm. But when it comes down, I mean, thank God these podcasts provide that opportunity, because you're one-on-one and you're here, and, you know, and I'm listening to you and representing the audience in that way, you know. It's hard to give people, even people we love and hold dear, probably more difficult with those people, the kind of attention and receptivity we ourselves so long for. Yeah, talk about that for a sec, because to me that's endemic to any kind of compassion.
Right, right, indeed. I mean, it's basic mindfulness, right, is what Dan Siegel called an actively receptive state. How often do we actually listen without planning what you're going to say next, right? How often do we really take in another person? How often do we really set aside our own agendas to be there for somebody else, or to, you know, offer our time or resources to another person? And it's healing to receive that. It's what we all long for. And what it's so difficult to get, even from the people that we're intimate with sometimes, to just really be listened to and heard and have somebody hold space for you. And it keeps me in business. Yeah. You know, but it's one of the reasons why therapy is so powerful, is a space people can come to actually receive that. And if your therapist is any good, then they are able to set aside what they're going to say next and just keep the space, so to speak, their mental space that they're projecting out into the room open and receptive and non-judgmental. And yes, as you said, this is all the precursor to compassion and emotional warmth.
Emotional intelligence as well. This is my friend Danny wrote that great book years ago, Danny Goleman.
Yeah.
That's another book everybody definitely check out. I mean, that's like a grounding that everyone needs to have.
Yeah.
In their day-to-day lives, emotional intelligence. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't understand our emotions, which are really what drive everything about us, right? If we're not feeling it, we're not doing it. If we are feeling it, we are doing it, right? But so often we don't understand what our emotions are, actually where they're coming from, you know, just their nature. They're such a powerful force.
There's so many great things in this book, Ralph, and I've only mentioned a couple because of the nature of the old podcast. So I do encourage people. The Monkey is the Messenger, Ralph De La Rosa, and there'll be links up on the show notes page of BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling, and also a way to get to you. Tell us, how can we get in touch with you? URL or something?
Yeah, I'm all over the place. But RalphDeLaRosa.com.
Okay, would be perfect.
Hub, and then Ralph De La Rosa on Instagram, on Twitter, And yeah, Facebook and et cetera. But yeah, that would be the easiest way, is just through the website.
Good. I just have to, another Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. You have one quote in here towards the end of the book, which has that chapter, working with the inner critic and other harsh, other considerably harsh inner voices. And people, you know, we all vouch for meditation as being a leverage, right, to really transform our belief and our thoughts and our stories and our movie of me, as we were just talking about. And listen to Trungpa, though. This is beautiful. You put this in there, Ralph. Meditation is not a matter of trying to achieve ecstasy, spiritual bliss, or tranquility, nor is it attempting to be a better person. It is simply the creation of a space in which we are able to expose and undo our neurotic games, our self-deception, our hidden fears and hopes.
Yeah.
That is so darn great. Just great.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. He said a lot of good things.
He certainly did. We used to go.
Very mysterious man.
Yeah. We used to go, Ram Dass, we had a family place, a farm in the Quebec hinterland, right near the border of Vermont, and one of the first established retreat places that Trungpa had was called Tale of the Tiger. It's now called something else, but I can't remember of it.
Karma Trolling.
And anyhow, we used to go down there, and he'd hang out. He was highly unusual, okay? He was not like your normal guru at all, okay? But he would give talks, and we'd go in, and he'd make fun of us, primarily Ram Dass, calling, yeah, here's the love and light people are back. He well knew our whole lineage with Neem Karoli Baba, and, you know, he respected and all that. But another being in which I would say cannot more highly recommend his Meditation in Action. Go there. It's just extraordinary. But this book is great, and it really feels like it connects to us, and I especially think of next generation people in a way that is so practical and real because of your experience. So this is thanks for doing this, man.
Yeah, I'm glad you got so much from the book, and thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So when's our coffee date now that we're BFF?
I'll be in New York. I will definitely get in touch before I come. Absolutely, we'll love it. Everybody, this is Mind Rolling on the Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com, and you'll find lots of other folks that we are both very fond of. Most especially in the Buddhist world. There's not a lot of Hindu people that have a grasp in the way that we're talking about, the grasp of the basic understanding that one can really work on themselves to get alongside of opening one's heart and allowing everything to come out and connecting in that way to true nature. So I don't know, we have these retreats, it's mostly Buddhist people, and it's, you know, Krishna Das, Ram Dass, me, Mirabai Bush, and so, you know, some other people. Nice. It's very strange. We have to engender some Hindus, for God's sake. All right, that's enough of that. This is Mind Rolling. Raghu, I'll see you next week.